So there is a chapter in the Life Divine, chapter 28, titled Mind and Supermind. 18, sorry. And it's quite relevant to all of the things we've been discussing. As is chapter 19 and chapter 24. So if you've been inclined to follow my recommendations regarding reading supplementary material, then you might want to just note those three chapters in the context of this course that we are finishing. Tonight, I just want to simply introduce you to a notion of physics. Don mentioned a few weeks back the concept of the irreversibility of time and evolution, and I said that that's a concept of physics. So tonight I'm going to look at that with you. I have some interesting references, and if you really are interested in pursuing the scientific dimension, there are some very good references. They're available in our library. I have made a copy of a book in the library, which is this book here, which is the authoritative book. Here it's 4 pages on 1 page, so it's quite a big volume. And it is called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle by Barrow and Tipler. Cosmological Principle. Here, you can look at it. So that's all for this today. More Life Divine. Okay, well, this should go off. Powering down. Another reference that you could look at is called Order Out of Chaos by Ilya Prigozhin. This person has the Nobel Prize in physics, and this book was written in 84, and this one, or published in 84, and this one was 86. And Sheldrake's Presence of the Past was 85. So the 80s seem to have been a good decade for an interface between science and cosmology. Cosmology means the study of the cosmos. And that normally means time and space and everything that happens therein. It's a very broad concept. Okay, but the reason, what I said was that the reason why they say that is because of a principle of physics, not a principle of biology. So we're going to discuss that a little bit. This is an area where physics and biology and metaphysics overlap. Physicists are trying to understand evolution. So Prigozhin is a physicist, but he's a biochemist, and so he makes a lot of references to chemistry and to biology and to philosophy, and he makes quite a few references to Bergson and Whitehead and Heidegger, who are the three philosophers that I'm always referring to, and he's very close in his thinking to us. So he's worth reading. And he's very highly respected in the world today as both a scientist and a philosopher, Ilya Prigozhin. Is anybody here a scientist? You have a background in science? You have a background in science, Paul?
Me? Yes, I work in a science museum, in a sense, Copernicus. So I have Copernicus and his lifetime, Galileo's eventually. Right. And I'm thinking antiquity of astronomy.
In a museum?
Yeah, in a museum. But I'm educated in French literature, grammar, history of French, philosophy, French, and French.
Okay.
Or Italian literature.
Yeah. Can you explain the principle of the second law of thermodynamics?
Action reaction, yes.
It's not simply action reaction.
Yeah, that's entropy, no?
Entropy, yes. Can you explain the concept of entropy?
It's the energy will always flow to the
I'm going to read a definition of the second law of thermodynamics to start with, and little by little maybe we will conceptualize this idea. And it's very closely related to the discussion which took place in the last hour about power and energy. If we really had the ability to understand what Vladimir was presenting in the last hour, which I very much doubt that we have, but if we had the ability to really understand that, then we would really understand this also, because they're very closely related, and they're very difficult to conceptualize, both the supramental idea of power and the concept of cosmological time and energy are both extremely abstract. And to have a mind which is able to engage those directly is simple proposition. So we're approaching the idea of evolution from both the metaphysical and the physical in this course, points of view. And the cosmological anthropic principle is a concept that both physicists and biologists have been toying with since the 1950s, actually, since around 1950, 5, but especially since the 80s. So we'll find out what it means tonight. Whether we understand what it means is another question altogether. Anyway, here's a definition of the second law of thermodynamics. The measure of the disorder of a system is a quantity termed entropy. The measure of the disorder of a system is a quantity termed entropy.
The last word, what is it?
Entropy. The measure of the disorder of a system now when the second law of thermodynamics was first developed, it was in the context of mechanics, corresponding to the law of conservation of energy. Matter is neither created nor destroyed, it simply changes its form. But when systems, the energy flow in systems began to be studied by someone named Boltzmann around the 1890s, a physicist named Boltzmann, he realized that this first law of thermodynamics or of energy conservation doesn't explain everything which happens in the transfer of energy. It explains engines, the heating up and cooling down of engines, but it doesn't really explain the transfer of energy in living systems. So the second law of thermodynamics, this one, is an attempt to come to terms with living systems. At a temperature of absolute zero, all movement of atoms and molecules ceases. And the disorder of such systems is zero. So when there is no movement of atoms and molecules, there is no loss of energy or gain of energy. It is static. Then there is no entropy to measure. So the idea of the second law of thermodynamics is that things tend towards a state of equilibrium. And living systems are open systems. So energy comes in and goes out all the time in living systems. And they do not tend towards equilibrium, except in very controlled circumstances. And so if you have cellular life or societies, individuals, organisms, cells, societies, these living systems, there is always energy coming in and energy going out. And it is very unusual for them to reach a state of equilibrium. But the body, when it's sleeping, for example, is not taking in or expending very much energy. So it's the measure of entropy approaches equilibrium. If you think about an evolving species, the general life style reaches a kind of equilibrium with the environment where the amount of energy that's being taken in and the amount of energy that's being expended is relatively balanced. But it's not really equilibrium, it's not a static state. If you reduce it to absolute zero, then it becomes a static state. But while living systems are functioning, they are taking in energy and expending energy all the time. So there is no real equilibrium that is ever reached.
But it's near.
It's, well, the system is always dying and the system is always recreating itself. So it's not even really near equilibrium, but it is relatively balanced.
Pseudo.
But the energy, just simple temperature changes in the environment are affecting the heat transfer of the organism. And so the body metabolism is always being maintained by organisms in relation to temperature changes in the environment.
So for pH of blood, light, physical laws are stable.
Okay, so let me just read the next statement here. All substances above absolute zero will have a positive entropy. A positive entropy value. That means a certain amount of disorder. Energy which is not being controlled, but which is being generated. So in your house all the time you're trying to maintain order and there's always a certain amount of disorder that results from your movement around and doing things and, you know, dirty dishes and laundry and so on, pile up. And so that that's a certain amount of disorder that you're familiar with as a result of life. So all substances above absolute zero will have a positive entropy value that increases with temperature. So if you put your pot of water on the stove, it's evaporating slowly. You turn on the heat and it starts to evaporate quickly. So the amount of disorder in that system is visible. It starts to just go crazy, you know, and those hydrogen and oxygen molecules are just popping into the air at a very rapid rate. And when it gets empty, the pan burns and it starts to smell bad because it disintegrates. And I mean, this positive entropy can just keep on going as long as you keep adding heat.
So the stars are very, 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 very positive.
Hmm.
You may think.
What? Say that again.
Stars are very positive.
Yes, the sun. The sun is just really pumping out entropy value at a very high level. Thank goodness for us, because we use up a lot of that chaotic energy in maintaining our systems of complexity. So here's the wonderful thing. Yes, here's the wonderful thing about entropy. Without it, there would be no life. Well, we'll get to that in a moment. Okay, when a hot body cools down, the thermal energy it loses passes to the surrounding air. So that's what Martin was saying. The energy goes into some other body. As one body cools, another one heats up. The energy has to go somewhere.
Energy is never lost.
No, it's being absorbed.
Transformed.
Transformed. Yeah. Another way of saying that is the entropy of the cooling body decreases and the entropy of the surrounding air increases. The air starts moving faster and things that are affected by the air temperature also start to be more affected. So the flies and mosquitoes move a little bit faster when the day cools down and the air is still warm. So for the last statement here is that for all processes of chemical change, which is basically all living processes and all processes in the biosphere, throughout the universe, energy is conserved, but entropy increases. Yes, the first law says energy is conserved. The second law says entropy increases. This is why time can't move backwards. Because every transformation in living systems which occurs is irreversible. In machinery, it's not the case. The machinery cools back down to its original state. But in the universe, it never goes back to its original state. It's continually, the sun is continually generating more energy, all the stars are generating energy, and the universe is expanding. And so there is no reversibility in life processes. The life process can go to a state of equilibrium, of very low entropy, but it can never go backwards. It can never grow backwards. Life doesn't grow backwards. And the cosmos doesn't shrink. Okay, every process, this is a law. We were talking last time about universals. Every process that a thermodynamic system may undergo can go in one direction only. Okay, every thermodynamic process, every system that undergoes thermodynamic processes, heating and cooling, can go in one direction only, and the opposite process in which both the system and its surroundings would be returned to their original states is impossible. Well, so now I'm going to read you a commentary from Ilya Prigozhin on this second law dynamics. It is no longer a question of irreversible transformations considered as approximate to reversible transformations, as in machinery, as in conservation of energy. It's no longer a question of irreversible transformations, because that question has been settled. Increasing entropy corresponds to the spontaneous evolution of the system. So, entropy is a proof of evolution. All systems don't reverse, they all evolve. The universe evolves. This was first discovered in the late 60s. And by the 80s, it was universally accepted that the universe itself is an evolutionary system. It is not a machine. And so this is where, you know, this proverbial idea that we hear all the time, Newtonian physics no longer explains anything well enough for us to pay much attention to it. It does still work within very controlled circumstances, but it doesn't explain relativity. It doesn't explain thermodynamics. Newtonian mechanics, which in themselves are absolutely brilliant, only explain certain closed systems. But open systems, systems which generate energy, are not explained by Newtonian physics. So, entropy, says Ilya Prigozhin, thus becomes an indicator of evolution, or an arrow of time. So, physics explains both the forward irreversible movement of time and the forward irreversible movement of evolutionary life. It can't go backwards even if it wants to.
And wants.
So the dinosaurs, the age of the lizards, became the age of the mammals as a result of pure physical laws, in addition to other things. There are also life principles involved, but even from the pure point of view of pure physical laws, this transformation from the age of the lizard to the ages of the mammals is a natural, inevitable, irreversible process.
About how you see that now, you let us see a little more humanity to think in this, the process of life always goes on. I think when I grow up, everything thought of fixed systems.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a minute. Because when we were growing up, there, one of the popular ideas in physics was that the solar system was going to die, that there was going to be a heat death of the solar system and the universe, and everything was going to go back to zero entropy. That no longer is a belief. In physics, that's no longer believed. It's going to expand indefinitely. It's expanding, yeah. And, this is where Penrose and Hawking proved the Big Bang theory, that there is an origin point. And as soon as you know the origin point of a system, you can measure entropy. And it can't go back to that point. Can't happen. So then they figured out the rate at which the universe is expanding. And as long as the universe is expanding, there is no end to it. There's no limit.
And the same goes here with this death, this concentration on death, I think it's connected.
It can be connected, yeah. So I'll read you some interesting conclusions that some scientists have drawn from this idea. So, it's an arrow of time. Entropy indicates that there is an arrow of time. Time does move in only one direction. Eddington called it that. For all isolated systems, the future is the direction of increasing entropy. So, the future means basically disorder, increasing disorder. All systems move in the direction of increasing disorder.
I mean, this word disorder.
disorder is relative, you know, like we use the term deconstruction in philosophy, and people get offended by this idea of deconstruction, which is not destructive at all. It just means that you look at everything from every possible angle, and you don't assume that there are fundamental constants with regard to ideas. So, anyway, Ilya Prigozhin says, increasing entropy is no longer synonymous with loss. So increasing disorder doesn't imply loss. But it now refers to the natural processes within the system. These are the processes that ultimately lead the system to thermodynamic equilibrium corresponding to the state of maximum entropy. Maximum disorder. Means stasis. There's nothing left in the system. It becomes.
Can't go back and it can't go.
It
back.
Dies. It disintegrates.
Black hole.
This is also referred to, interestingly, as the loss of memory of the initial state. So systems tend, our bodies tend to recover whenever they're sick or whenever they're tired or whenever they're overextended, they recover. They remember their initial state. They don't remember their initial state, which is the seed state, the embryonic state. They don't go back to that state. But psychologically, we know that they try to. So, you know, there is a tendency to go back to the womb state of comfort and warmth and unconsciousness. Yeah. And Freud discovered that there is a death instinct. And he's absolutely right about that. It's a very important discovery. So there is a tendency towards equilibrium. Now, one of the things that Ilya Prigozhin points out that excites him the most is that the state of equilibrium is the state of highest probability. So if there's energy passing between two containers of oxygen and hydrogen, and temperature causes the movement from one to the other, and then it loses heat back to the first one, and so there's an equilibrium state where there's an equal amount of hydrogen and oxygen in both compartments, and that is the state of highest probability with respect to where the molecules are located. There's a very high probability that 50% will be located in this side and 50% will be located in that side, because as they cool down, the movement reduces and they tend to equalize, the two containers tend to equalize the temperature loss and temperature gain. And so the state of equilibrium is the state of highest probability in a system. If the system is heated up, if we're under a lot of stress and pressure and we're losing energy faster than we can get it back, and we are as far as possible from equilibrium, then our behavior becomes least predictable. So there is the lowest level of probability with respect to the behavior of a system at that at that distance from equilibrium. The farther a system is from equilibrium, the least probable is its behavior. So isn't this interesting? Physics transferred to societies or to cells or to psychological states. You know, there's an easy sort of metaphorical transfer that makes sense there. So if you take the population of humanity right now, for example, which is at the highest level that it has ever been, and it is probably getting close to its farthest point from possible equilibrium, and what it's going to do, what the species is going to do in order to ensure its survival, is quite unpredictable because it's never happened before. So there's a famous systems theorist named Wolfram, and if anyone here is a mathematician, you'll know about Wolfram. Wolfram's systems are becoming more and more well known, and he has shown that the future is basically unpredictable, and the future of every system is unpredictable beyond what has already happened to it in the past. So as long as you can determine the circumstances of a system with respect to what has happened to it before under similar circumstances, you can predict to a certain extent what will happen to it. But any living system is unpredictable beyond those pathways that it has already traversed. So we like to be within regular boundaries so that we can predict our own behavior up to a certain point, because that makes us feel good and stable. And when we're not able to do that, we sense that our behavior is, and our future and so on, are unpredictable. And this is true for all systems. So, irreversible processes have an immense constructive importance. : Life would not be possible without them. Life would not be possible without irreversibly dynamic systems. They are equal to life. Life, that's what life is. It's an irreversible, dynamic, open system. It takes in energy and it expends energy, and it only approaches equilibrium. It never arrives at equilibrium. And when it is farthest from equilibrium, there is a phenomenon that Ilya Prigozhin has identified called bifurcation.
Called bifurcation.
Bifurcation, yeah. It can either go this way or that way. And so in the development of the embryo, he says that there are stages where a development has been achieved and the next development has to be triggered, and this is where the molecules are deciding which way to go. And they know from habit or from genetics or whatever, more or less, which way to go. And so then another organ develops. And then, so life keeps on going like this. As we grow and develop, we reach points of disequilibrium where we have to decide, are we going this way or are we going that way? Are we going to adopt this status or that status? And then after we make the decision, we we progress, we adapt, we adjust ourselves to that new level of interchange of energy with our environment. And this is where we start to recognize that energy is information. You know, but the biologists have been telling us this all along. Every cell in every organism is dealing with energy transfers that tell it what it needs and what it doesn't need, and it knows to start assimilating more of this and rejecting that poison and taking in this sugar or that sugar. And so this process of thermodynamics starts to evolve into a process of consciousness. Cognition, at the level of cellular life, cognition is thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is cognition. Matter and consciousness are obeying the same laws. So when Sri Aurobindo says that spirit and matter...
analogous laws, analogous, not the same. Consciousness and matter cannot obey the same laws in weather.
No, they have to obey the same laws.
In the parameters, in the context.
And this is a breakthrough in consciousness itself. So Roger Penrose, in his last book, says... there must be something going on at the microscopic quantum level that corresponds to what's going on at the macrocosmic conscious level. We don't know what it is, but he says consciousness, which is going on right now on the macroscopic level, must have a corresponding phenomenon going on at the quantum level. That's another way of saying that the laws of thermodynamics become conscious in us because they were mind phenomena to start with. And if you read those chapters of Sri Aurobindo, he says that the dynamics of matter, which are defined by science, are the processes of mind. That it is mind which is doing that at the atomic level. Mind is dividing and synthesizing on the atomic level. It is mind. So, if you read those three chapters, you will be amazed that Sri Aurobindo is saying again and again, mind is the operation of supermind on the material level. Not just on the mental level. In evolutionary terms, it's on the intellectual, mind has reached the intellectual level in our processes. But long before life evolved these organisms, when it was only a cosmic soup, that was mind at that level of evolution. He says there is absolutely no difference between mind and atomic structure.
But then this becomes difficult in determining life as we do it now.
Say it again.
I think it becomes difficult when we hear this to say life is this what we determine up to now. Maybe we have to think about what is life.
Yeah. So anyway, let me just recommend strongly that you read the chapter called Mind and Supermind, and the chapter called Life, and the chapter called Matter. Because in all three of those chapters, he says about 100 times, mind is supermind in the form of atoms. And all of the divisions of energy in the cosmos are mental phenomena. The division of energy, what we're talking about here, these physical processes that are being measured are the processes of mind.
Last question. If you have a holographic picture, you can cut it and you will always still have the same picture. You can cut it as much as you want and the full picture will always be here. Is there a relationship between this constant in the holographic picture and the mind?
Right. We are conscious of so little. So Sri Aurobindo says it's possible to evolve consciousness to the point where we don't any longer distinguish between ourselves and other selves. We no longer make that distinction. And we no longer make a distinction between spiritual and material and vital energy. It is all our consciousness, but we don't realize it now. It is all. So now, that's the introduction. Now we go to the cosmological anthropic principle. We haven't gotten there yet.
I'm sorry to bother everybody, but what's one of those three chapters of my divine mind and supermind?
Mind and supermind was chapter 14.
80 and 94.
Yeah, which books?
First book. It's the first part. So I'm just going to read to you a few passages from this amazing book. On the basis of what we've just heard, they will be more comprehensible. First of all, I'm going to define the weak anthropic principle and then the strong anthropic principle. The weak anthropic principle tries to tie a precise statement to the notion that any cosmological observations made by astronomers are biased by an all-embracing selection effect, our own existence. Everything that we observe is biased by our experience, our relative understanding and our exposures and so on. Everything that we observe as humans. This approach, well, this approach to evaluating unusual features of our universe first re-emerges in modern times in a paper written in 1955 by somebody named Wittrow, who asked this question: why does space have three dimensions? We perceive space in three dimensions. Why does space have three dimensions? Because that's how we see things, right? Because Kant defined it like that? Oh, Descartes, okay. But why did Descartes define it like that? Why is it, in fact, like that? So here is the first cosmological argument, the cosmological anthropic argument. And I better put this word up here. Anthropic. Anthropos, you know. Anthropos means the human being. So it is not anthropomorphic. That means the form of the human being. If we say that God is an intelligent, loving person with two arms, 2 feet, and a long beard, that is anthropomorphic. But this is not that. This is anthropic. And this is the first argument. Witrow argued that this three-dimensional feature of the world is not unrelated to our own existence as observers of it. When formulated in three dimensions, mathematical physics possesses many unique properties that are necessary for the existence of rational information processing. So, if we're going to have a rational understanding of things, there must be at least three dimensions. Otherwise, we don't have spatial relationships. And this is something that Vladimir pointed out in Sanskrit that was recognized from the beginning of the Sanskrit language. That movement from here to there, the object and the subject, all kinds of qualitative changes that we define in existence, all kinds of relationships. Relationship, let's just boil it down to that. The idea of relationship between this and that, between now and then, between here and there, all relationships imply three dimensions. If there were only two dimensions, there would be no relationships.
You know this cartoon about the man in two dimensions moving on the line? There are some type of relationships there also. But it's getting very tricky, and it's very interesting.
It's only the relationship of a point. It has no depth or breadth. So anyway, there is a consciousness which corresponds to that, but it's not very bright. It's not rational. It's not a rational consciousness.
But I was always fascinated by it because it's very interesting if you have only two dimensions.
Okay, then Witrow pointed out that the expansion of the universe creates an unbreakable link between its overall size and age and the density of material within it. This connection reveals that only a very large universe is a possible habitat for life, because there's a certain density of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and zinc, and phosphorus, and all of these elements that we have here had to be forged by suns. Our sun isn't hot enough to forge anything except helium. So for all of these elements that constitute life to come into existence, the universe has to be as large as it is, and to have taken the amount of time, 13 billion years, to expand to the extent that it has expanded, was a necessity for there to be carbon-based life. So here is the weak anthropic principle in a nutshell. The observed values of all physical and cosmological quantities, that means the weights and sizes of atoms and molecules and star systems and so on, are, all these sizes are not equally probable, but they take on values restricted by the requirement that there exist sites where carbon-based life can evolve, and by the requirement that the universe be old enough for it to have already evolved. The values that we give to the age of the universe, the size of the universe, the atomic table of particles, all of those values that we give presuppose their existence, their relative necessity in a living world, in a world where life exists. If life didn't exist, all of these things wouldn't have the value that they have. The value that they have, in fact, is that they make life possible. Otherwise, they would have no value, because there would be no one there to evaluate them. This is the weak cosmological anthropic principle in a nutshell.
There are carbon-based microchips now?
Yeah. Carbon has the highest memory of any substance. We'll get to that in a moment. Carbon itself is the element which has the highest memory capacity of any higher than silicon. Silicon doesn't have the capacity to form the basis of life for reasons that we can discuss. They are atomic, have to do with atomic bonding. Carbon has an equally great memory value, and it can form the basis of life, and it is the only substance, because of its weight, because of its bondability, it alone can form the basis of life as we know it. There is no other molecule, other or atom, capable of forming molecules like carbon, and it forms this complex geometric structure which keeps on building and building and building and remembering all of its previous forms. So even when you break it down, it still has the same shape, and you break it down further, and so we're made of carbon, and carbon itself is pure mind. Just because you don't see it. Okay, let me move on here. We can also give some examples of how the weak anthropic principle leads to synthesizing insights that deepen our appreciation of the unity of nature. This principle deepens our appreciation of the unity of nature. And when we started this evolution course very back in the beginning, a year ago, first session, we said that the idea of evolution itself can form the basis of a value system, and that value system can be more important to the survival of human beings than any other value system. The value system that is implied by the fact of evolution is now becoming dominant in the human species, and it will be the value system that determines the survival of the human species, if anything does.
Can you
some way. We've been elaborating for about, I don't know, 60 hours. Okay, so I'm going to elaborate a little bit here. We observe some facts in relation to the conditions necessary for our own existence and their dependence on the constants of physics. Facts that are necessary for our existence that are dependent upon the constants of physics. Let us consider. Relating the size of the universe to the period of time necessary to generate observers. Conscious observers. The size of the universe related to the time necessary to generate observers. The requirement that enough time pass for cosmic expansion to cool off sufficiently after the Big Bang to allow the existence of carbon. So we know that the Big Bang generated like 10 to the nth power energy, which has brought about the gradual or rapid, who knows how time looks from that perspective, the 13 billion years for the universe to cool down sufficiently for there to be at least one planet among a billion galaxies with a billion suns, with a billion planets, for there to be at least one which is capable of supporting life. And we know that there's at least one.
So now the National Geographic, they are hypothesizing the that could support life.
So what was...
Because the boundary of the observable universe expands at the speed of light. The nuclei of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus of which we are made are cooked from the light, from the light primordial nuclei of hydrogen and helium by nuclear reactions in stellar interiors. But our sun is not hot enough to produce all of them. It only produces helium, which fuses to make hydrogen and a few others, but the cosmic dust has brought together all of these other minerals. And when a star nears the end of its life, it disperses these biological precursors throughout space. So many stars have exploded and died and sent the necessities of life into space. That took a certain amount of time. The time required for stars to produce carbon and other bioactive elements in this way is roughly the lifetime of a star on the main sequence of its evolution. And there is a formula for the main sequence of a star, which is called T star equals. And T star equals Gm squared over n over hc times h over mnc delta 10 to the 10th power years. So this is a mathematical formula. It's based on gravitational constants, the velocity of light, and Planck's constant, and the mass of protons. So if one follows out this formula of the mass of protons, which we know, the velocity of light, which we know, the gravitational constant, which we know, which we can measure for any system. So these are what was referred to as the constants of physics that we know of, on which life is dependent. If we do this if they do this calculation, then we find that the universe must be at least as old as T star, and hence, by virtue of its expansion, at least as the age of CT star, which is roughly 10 billion light years.
So what was before that?
We.
Can't even answer. Before that? What was before that?
Yeah, what was before that?
No time, no space for figuring that.
Okay, anyway. No one should be surprised to find the universe to be as large as it is and as old as it is, because we could not exist now if it was any less or any smaller. Okay, so that is known as the weak anthropic principle.
Question, why there is a limited number of atoms possible? They can't be smaller than hydrogen, and they can't be bigger than a transuranium thing.
Yeah, there's a very interesting section here on carbon and the size of carbon and hydrogen and why they are the size that they are. And the reason why they can't be any bigger or smaller is because they are essentially mind. And mind is what is evolving in this universe. This is a universe of mind, and the job of mind in this universe is to create all of these mathematical relationships so that life can emerge in its thermodynamic systems, so that mind can emerge as an intellectual, rational, knowing entity that can itself evolve supermind. Because mind is only an emanation of supermind in the material cosmos. But supermind can change carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen into another form of substance, which is so far unknown, that is capable of universal conscious being and power. Universal conscious being and power is not a capacity of mind. But what is a capacity of mind is rational intelligence, which knows its limits and knows the limits of everything else, and can align itself cosmically with a vibration that allows it to evolve another degree of substance. And that other degree of substance will be a cosmic substance. And then we get some very interesting projections that come from these guys who know all of this. I'll just read you a tantalizing one to end this discussion. Very tantalizing. Well, you want to know the strong anthropic principle? Okay, here's the strong anthropic principle without giving you any mathematical equations, but there are some nice ones. It says, the universe must have those properties which allow life to develop within it at some stage in its history. Now, if we want to tack on a Sri Aurobindo strong anthropic principle, we could say the universe must have those properties which allow mind to develop within it at some stage in its history, by which we mean higher mind or universal mind or spiritual consciousness. Because that's what he says. And the reason why he says that is because that's what the universe is made of to start with.
But even if the life develops, it cannot develop beyond a certain point, because the atom of the highest stage which exists is falling apart. Transuraniums have the tendency to fall apart and not to form anything. The last transuraniums
No. That's the old mechanical concept. Listen, the discovery of the expanding universe, okay, that was in the 60s. The discovery of the expanding universe in the early part of the 20th century, middle 20th century, changed the picture of the heat death concept. It used to be thought that in the end, all the matter of the universe would collect into one rather dense ball at uniform temperature. But the doctrine of the spherical space, and more especially the recent results as to the expansion of the universe, have changed that. It is widely thought that matter slowly changes into radiation. So it just keeps getting hotter and more luminous. If so, it would seem that the universe will ultimately become a ball of radiation, growing ever larger, the radiation becoming thinner, and passing into longer and longer wavelengths. In his classic work of speculative cosmology, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, written in 1929, the physicist Bernal tried to picture what life would be like in the far future of such a universe. He says, finally, consciousness itself may end or vanish in a humanity that has become completely etherealized, losing the close-knit organism, becoming masses of atoms in space communicating by radiation, and ultimately perhaps resolving itself entirely into light. These beings, nuclearly resident, so to speak, in a relatively small set of mental units, each utilizing the bare minimum of energy, connected together by a complex of ethereal intercommunications, and spreading themselves over immense areas and periods of time by means of inert sense organs, which, like the field of their active operations, would be in general at a great distance from themselves. As the scene of life would be more the cold emptiness of space than the warm, dense atmosphere of the planets, the advantage of containing no organic material at all, so as to be independent of both of these conditions, heat and cold, would be increasingly felt. The advantage of having less organic material and more radiant energy would be felt.
Which means there would be no to eat or consume and
now,
it would be no
that's just science fiction speculation.
No death. One moment, the song will be finished. So
this
is the solution. Yeah, we have a solution
for our organization.
We
should propose.
And so then the carbon microchips will take over?
Well, that's another science fiction scenario. Okay, so now you know the anthropic principle. You know that scientists are thinking about the cosmos as being necessarily intelligent. And I was going to read you from Richard Dawkins, who has some really colorful descriptions of the anthropic principle, worth reading. Mainly because he's a biologist and he has such a great respect for life. And so this, to him, he likes this anthropic principle because there's no God implied in it, and yet everything, the purpose of everything, is perfectly explainable in terms of physics and natural selection together.
Did he ever read Sri Aurobindo?
Of course not. But he has read these books, and he refers to them, and he's a, you know, he's a materialist, Darwinian materialist. So these people are trying to envision the integral meaning of existence, because they have such a load of information about matter, life, and mind at all levels now that they're beginning to see the interconnectedness of everything and the coherence of everything and the mutual necessity and meaning of everything to everything else. So at some point they have to start radiating a kind of, you know, empathy with all of that world that they know, and then we'll find that we're all friends. The spiritualists and the materialists will shake hands, and as Sri Aurobindo says in The Life Divine, there absolutely is no God out there designing all of this. Supermind is absolutely here and now in all of this, and everything is what it is because of that, and there is no need whatsoever for any theology of external divine intervention.
So intelligent design doesn't apply to us?
No, it doesn't.
So what is the divine consciousness?
What is? I mean, we have to agree with the biologists that no intelligent designer would have made this mess. It can only be explained as an evolutionary adventure of consciousness.
What would be the consciousness of the necessary process?
Meditation.
This is awesome.
Etherealization.
Okay. The last thing you said there is a real bomb. I know a bomb, I don't mean in a negative way yet, but you just made something else than you misconception.
Good.
No, but then you got to continue. So, like Ingo said, when's the next
class? When is the next
class? September. Have a long time to digest. And lots of things to read. Thanks for keeping me entertained.
Well, the term divine used by Aquinas, what is it meant?
What's meant is the reality that you don't see because you're ignorant.
That ignorance is absolutely.
They're not just you, but the reality that we don't see because we're ignorant. That's the divine. But we have a chance to evolve a mechanism for seeing it.